And welcome to the Comicast, Ireland's number one comic book podcast. This is why we win awards. I'm Craig.
I'm Liam.
And we're here with our Tintin special.
Tintin special.
T-I-N space T-I-N. Tintin.
No, it's all together. It's all one word. As specified earlier, I'm doing a public service here.
Yeah.
Tintin. Capital T-I-N-T-I-N. As one name, one word.
Sure.
Please stop putting a space in between them. Please stop giving a capital T to the second tin. You know,
it's just one name, Tintin. Yeah, just a stupid name.
Just get it right.
But it's one name.
Craig is a stupid name.
Liam Garrity.
So we're here to talk about Tintin. Yeah, we're here to talk about Tintin. And we should probably explain why you have very much less involvement in this show.
I hate Tintin. I hate him like I hate fucking AIDS. If I was given a choice, get rid of AIDS or get rid of Tintin. I don't know which I choose. It would be tough. I'd probably choose Tintin.
Okay.
I want to go on a rant a bit more about how much I know, we'll leave that till after.
Yeah.
We'll roll the good bits.
So, because presumably if you've tuned in, you like Tintin and would like maybe to hear about him. So on today's show, later on, we have a guest reviewer, someone to step into Phil Craig's boots.
Sure.
So we turn to illustrator extraordinaire Brenby, who went to see the film. So,
Bren Spacebee or
Bren? Capital B, I don't know. Later on, we'll be going to talk to him. I will be reviewing the art of The Adventures of Tintin, the film, the book from Weta. Peter Jackson's thing. And we'll mention a few other little Tintin things. But first, we're going to start the show off with this.
Walking down Nassau Street at 5:30 on a Thursday evening, it's pretty busy. But as soon as you turn onto South Frederick Street, you enter a kind of oasis of calm. And one of the first shops you'll see is International Books. If you were to look at the Google Street Map view of International Books, you'd see a pleasant green shopfront with some language books sitting in the window. Italian dictionaries, Polish phrase books, that sort of thing. And I can't imagine many people stopping to stare in. But now, that's exactly what people are doing. Because now the shopfront has been repainted to the colours of a certain famous Belgian reporter, while inside the window has been decorated with plush toys of his faithful dog. And all because International Books, an unassuming independent bookshop, is the official Irish home to Tintin. The famous boy reporter has been all over the world, fighting drug dealers in China, spying on Bolsheviks in Soviet Russia, even went to the moon. But for his Irish adventure, Tintin stopped in to help rescue Brendan Story's bookshop.
I was trying to dream up an idea of where the business was going and what would I do next. And I looked at Google and I started thinking about other things. And then all of a sudden, Tintin said, somewhere, looked me up. I looked them up and I then was speaking very shortly with the people in the foundation of Tintin Moulinzar in Brussels. And I took it from there. I had two trips to Brussels and I spoke with the owners and the commercial section of the foundation, and we set up an agreement that I would become sort of their main man in Ireland, to say the least. But I mean, it's an adventure. Even though there's been trouble with certain books at the start of Hergé's work, I think the character as maybe the innocent hero of some inquisitive kid thinking he's a great journalist and going out there and saying, I want to know all about you, or we're going to go this place and that place and we're going to find out the secrets of everything about how the world evolves. Like, I mean, to have the rocket's going to the moon before Armstrong went to the moon, I mean, that just tells you. I mean, the imagination of any child or any, you know, person who wants to be adventurous, that's where it would bring you. Like, you'll go on an adventure with Tintin right through all the books. For me, it's been a crazy bit of noise for my business, because it's like, as I said, how was I going to keep business moving to a certain extent and make people more attractive to my store? And Tintin came along and I said, okay, I'm going to do this. And I put Tintin in the window, and he's been there actually in the window since mid-May. And he hasn't been out of the window. There's been nobody else in the window but Tintin. Recently, I met Taoiseach at a conference, and I presented him with the 2012 Tintin calendar and pocket agenda. And so got a few photos with Enda Kenny, and he was quite receiving. And I told him that Tintin had come into my life basically since earlier in the year, and he was going to help my business and my friends and anyone who liked
So might Tintin. We see Enda going around with Tintin pocket diary?
Maybe so. I mean, the thing actually is that when you look at some images of Tintin, he's not too far off from the centre of being the world's real man in Brussels.
Yeah.
You know? And actually that morning, he had only flown back from Brussels, and I more or less said to him, you mustn't have time to go downtown to see Tintin's boutique and so forth, but here you are. I'm going to present you with these, and he took them gracefully. I mean, I would love to see it eventually coming into Oscailige, so we are talking to people and seeing if we can move things on. And that's where I'll come to sort of storybooks, which is going to be the Tintin website in a few weeks' time, where it'll be all just about Tintin. And I'll be just using my own name as the distribution person for Tintin in Ireland. So anybody who has any problems looking for Tintin anymore, they don't have to go to London or Brussels or Paris. They can just go to downtown Dublin. or just, you know what I mean, log on to storybooks.ie. And we're working on putting a blog up, and Facebook is already up. We have actually put on Facebook the Ireland Tintin fan club. But every kid needs a hero, and every adult needs a hero, so we just keep, you know, living.
And we're back. That was Brendan's story of the International Books shop in Dublin on South Frederick Street, where you can check out all the Tintin stuff. And he's got two websites, with both of which we have linked up below, where you can check out his store. Yes, so now, Steven Spielberg has done this film, which he refused to see.
Yeah. Why have you refused to see this film?
Well, I just have no interest in it.
I have no interest.
It's not like...
I'm not, like, angry about it. Like, I don't like the animation. Like, I'm willing to be convinced, but in terms of even, like, the Polar Express and Christmas Carol, I don't like that sort of... I don't know, sure, what you call it, but yeah, that kind of animation doesn't do it for me. And okay, I don't particularly like the look of Tintin in this. He looks... I don't know. Maybe you disagree as a bigger Tintin fan.
Yeah, we'll find out now as I go to join Brenby in Temple Bar in the Offset offices. Brenby.
Yes.
The Adventures of Tintin. We're going to review it. You're a guest reviewer. How does that feel?
Well, it's an honour. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't an honour. It's probably the greatest honour of my career so far. It's the highlight. My whole life has been building up to this point. A return. A glorious return to the comic cast.
If you're good enough, I'll let you replace Craig.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Let's pull up our socks and...
I guess it all depends on whether I like the movie or not, because I got the sense that if I don't like it, this isn't even going to make it onto the thing.
So we're going to review The Adventures of Tintin, the Steven Spielberg, Peter Jackson movie. I guess we should say it's based on three Tintin comic books, mainly The Secret of the Unicorn, and then with a bit from The Crab with the Golden Claws.
Right.
To introduce Haddock, and then the ending, strangely, of Red Rackham's Treasure.
Treasure, yeah.
What'd you think?
Well, let's see.
Where to start?
Okay, well, let's start generally speaking.
Okay.
I think it was good. But I'll qualify that by saying that my expectations were extremely low. I guess the set pieces, the action, everything was well done. The backgrounds, the artwork was nice to look at. It's the characters, there was some funny moments in it. It was exciting. I mean, it had everything you expect from a Spielberg movie, I guess, apart from loads of naked Jews going into the showers. But I think that's in the sequel, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a different arc.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, I don't know. I liked it. Going in, I thought I was going to hate it. And I guess we'll get to the 3D aspect of it later.
I guess, yeah. We'll leave that for the minute.
Okay.
I have to say, I'm pretty much the same. I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. You know what? When it started off, the credit sequence is kind of, it's similar to Catch Me If You Can,
yeah.
With the little kind of animated Tintin running around other Tintin stories.
Yeah.
There's lots of nods and winks to.
I would have loved to seen the whole movie done in that style.
Yeah. Like animated.
The movie is animated.
Yeah, well,
you know, I mean, that, right?
Yeah, sorry, 2D. Yeah, so,
it
fooled me.
Because if they're not going to do it in a replica, say, of Hergé's style, I would have liked to have seen that. It's still a flat, in terms of the aesthetic. I just think it suits. The translation from the flat Hergé style into this kind of real world, in inverted commas, I'm not sure how successful that was from a purely aesthetic point of view. I think it worked in the story and a lot of effects and the chases and everything worked. But from the beautiful artwork of Hergé to the movie, the movie isn't as beautiful or nice to look at, I didn't think.
Yeah, no, yeah, I absolutely agree. Later on the show, I'm going to review the art of Tintin book, but just actually something I read in that about how when they were trying to Tintinify or Hergé-ify, these characters into real world, they still couldn't get the measurements right. They still had to be, if they did make them right, other things would look weird. Like their heads were kind of a little bit too big, so they actually had to accentuate their hands of most of the characters. So just to make them not look really creepy.
Well, there is always this kind of thing, where they try and it's hard. The only thing I find difficult is trying to describe someone the characters are now in 3D, right? As in, they're three-dimensional.
Yeah.
But then the movie's in 3D as well. And, that's kind of confusing when you're trying to describe it. What I'm talking about is the translation between Tintin being a flat-coloured drawing to being now fully rounded in three dimensions. And they still have cartoon character faces. Some more so than others, I guess. But I suppose Hergé does that too.
Yeah.
But then the backgrounds are so perfectly realized that I think sometimes it jars a little bit.
Okay,
so you have this kind of perfectly realized brick wall, say, and then this outrageously cartoonified character.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Now, when you look at the original comic books, the backgrounds are always meticulously drawn and researched, and then you've got a kind of, big nose cartoon character in the middle of it. But I think because the two things are colored and drawn in a kind of a flat kind of way, it works better than in the movie.
Yeah. No, you're right. There's one particular scene at night time when they're overlooking a dock, and it's just a ship. And I just thought that looked like it could have just been filmed. It looked really.
I mean, that's the trouble, I think, with a lot of CGI now, is that everything is so sharply realized. They haven't got around. I don't think they've, for me anyway, satisfactorily got away to dull things down in the way real human eyes work. Like, everything is super sharp. You can look at any part of the screen and everything's in focus. And that just, I think, it hurts your eyes, I think, if nothing else.
Okay. What do you think of, in terms of the motion capture? Because this has been, with the Robert Zemeckis and the Polar Express, since the Polar Express, people aren't entirely sold on it. And I wasn't entirely sold at all. Like, I looked at a clip of the Polar Express last night, and it hasn't aged well. Like, it's how many years old is that? A couple. And
in fairness, it didn't age well when it first came out either. It looked terrible.
It looks like in-game kind of, or the cutscenes for a computer game.
And that's doing a disservice to cutscenes.
It horrible.
It's really strange how, obviously there's probably all these side things that are being developed that are helping other parts of film become better and better. But the motion capture thing, I'm not sure I'm sold on, you know, I think there's, I mean, Gollum in Lord of the Rings' motion capture, I guess that was quite well done. There's one thing that I don't like about it, though, is everything just seems so light. There's no weight in any of the characters. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's anything to do with the motion capture or not.
Right.
But just when you see, like, there's bits like in the Tintin movie where they're going through the desert and they're walking on the sand dunes. And I was looking down at their feet, and the sand is—it really looks like sand is moving, and it's
perfect.
You know, anything that's kind of inanimate, they can animate perfectly, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when you put when they put the character on it, even though the foot is going down on the sand, and the sand is moving the way it should do, it's like there's an air cushion in between their foot and and the sand, and it just there's no weight. Like Snowy, particularly, who's a main character in it, when he runs around, it's kind of like he's not really touching the ground or something. It's like there's no sense of gravity anywhere, pushing people down and making them feel real. And that's a problem I have with kind of CGI in general.
Okay.
And specifically in this, I thought it was very apparent.
Right. Well, in terms of when it opened, I actually thought it was quite a flat opening, if you'll excuse the pun, for the 2D thing. But I wasn't, I was excited to see
the opening scene.
The opening credits and the music. Actually, the music. Let's just jump onto the music since I've just remembered. I did not know this was scored by John Williams until after the film. And I didn't think it was a particularly good score at all.
It didn't grab me at all.
Yeah,
it sounded like kind of, you know, music or film score 101.
Yeah.
Obvious stuff. But I mean, I guess Williams does, he's so ubiquitous, particularly with Spielberg. You almost don't hear it anymore.
Maybe, but I thought being so, Tintin is such a, especially with the theme tune to the 1990s cartoon.
Right. I don't remember that. Yeah.
Well, it was such a, the opening to that bit, for people who've seen that, is a fantastic kind of opening. It's a really, you know, adventure's going to happen.
Right.
It's really
interesting. The tone and the energy.
Yeah, where it was just,
it was very muted. It definitely was muted.
Yeah, yeah.
But even the opening credits, the way they're designed, it was kind of like plinky plinky plonk.
Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah,
there was no. Yeah, there was no.
Like, this is gonna be an adventure. It was just like, this is like a jazz club.
Yeah,
laid back.
Yeah,
I didn't.
No, I get what you mean.
Like
I didn't
notice
it, but yeah.
Once the film, once we get to the characters, once we meet Tintin, it all kicks off. Then it doesn't stop. You know, then we're just falling into one thing after the other.
And that's, I think that perfectly mirrors what happens in the book.
Yeah,
like. Well, one of the great things about the Tintin books is the fact that, you know, from page to page, you can be going across continents and stuff. I guess one of the things I have, I came to Tintin not as a kid. Mm. I never read the books when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I came, maybe late teenager years, as I was getting more into comics and European comics. I was, you know, rediscovering some of these things that I missed out on. So I don't really have this nostalgia for Tintin in the way other people might. Mm. But what I think what troubles me about the movie is what troubles me about the books.
Okay.
In that the stories are a little bit too light at times and too dark in other times. And there's kind of, it can flip from one, almost from panel to panel. It can be like, you know, Tintin is about to get shot and then someone will slip in a banana skin.
Yeah.
And it's just this kind of jarring of you know, heightened excitement and fear, like it's washed away by, you know, someone opening a portal of a ship and hitting the gunman in the face, and it's
I know what you mean. I think that's I think that probably is a kind of, because Tintin does seem to be actually quite a Marmite thing, which I didn't like. I used to think that Tintin was a generally kind of loved character, and obviously he is a huge character, but
he's very hard to love, though, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
He's so wet. He's a wet character.
I love him as a character.
Well, the one thing that I kept thinking of when I was watching the movie, apart from how much it reminded me how much I hated his character, right, was how much he reminded me of Frodo from Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And I guess the immediate thing that reminded me was that Jamie Bell, the actor who does the voice on the motion capture for Tintin, actually really sounded like Frodo.
Right.
He reminded, the way he was talking, and Snowy was like, whatever, who's the guy that follows Frodo around?
One of some of the other hobbits.
Yeah, his little guy. Anyway,
yeah.
He keeps turning to Snowy the same way that Frodo was turning to, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Please edit in the right name.
I think Tintin is a little bit more hard ass than that, though. I think Frodo does seem to be quite Elijah Wood's face is in my head now, being all kind of like cutesy and whatever. But I actually think reading, because I reread all the comic books that this film was based on recently, and I kind of forgot what a bit of an asshole Tintin was at times, like to people. And
yeah, he's
very hot-headed. He gets very angry quite easily about things.
Yeah, and he's very focused on just pushing people out of the way to get to the problem.
Yes.
And but the thing about it is, because he's so focused on that, he doesn't really develop as a character. You know, not to get into another debate, but it is aimed at kids.
Yeah. Right?
Now we can enjoy it for lots of different reasons. It's certainly not like, you know, Toy Story. It doesn't have, I don't think it has things in it that appeals to
adults. It doesn't in that kind of modern way. But no. I remember like when the Tintin magazine came out, and this is where he kind of got his big break back in, I think it was in the 40s. And their thing was, they used to put, you know, Tintin for age 7 to 77. Because it was just kind of...
Yeah, that's a marketing
classic. That's true. But I think there's a bit of truth.
It was quite
in that.
Violent in a lot of places. Yeah. There was lots of guns gone off and
racist in some early.
Yeah, well, you know, who wasn't back then? I think you were allowed to be racist. I mean, you know, certain people's companies still are. But again, getting back to that, there's the kind of, you know, panel to panel in the comics. You got this violence and you got slapstick humor. And there's no character development. Like, as soon as you meet, maybe Captain Haddock does kind of change slightly as the books go on, and even in the movie. But Tintin is the same at the beginning as at the end. The Thompson twins are the same. The baddie was terrible in this movie, by the way.
Yeah, he wasn't great. And that probably... It was maybe interesting. I don't know how well you kind of remember the specific comics that this film was based on. But, I mean, this villain was created out of a character who wasn't a villain in the comic books. He was literally just, we met him briefly, and he was a collector who was trying to find a ship that Tintin has bought, and that's all he was. And so for the purposes of this film, he's been transformed into this villain. And yeah, you're right.
So they've taken a good bit of liberty then in terms of changing the story.
They have.
To invent this character. This villain.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
In that case, because I thought they were being a little bit, you know, precious about not changing the story. So if now that you've said that, then that changes everything.
Right. Okay.
Because they should have changed a lot more then to make it a better. Like I said earlier, generally speaking, I thought it was entertaining and visually interesting, and there was certainly some of the set pieces, like the big, you know, without going into giving away any spoilers or anything. There's a big. Chase scene through this Moroccan town.
It's fantastic.
And it's really amazing. It's pure Indiana Jones, except multiplied by 1,000.
And not in the kind of Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skulls. No. Kind of, like, it is crazy, ridiculous stuff happening, but it's not... It probably helps that it's not live action.
It's like the Keystone Cops and Buster Keaton. You know, it's a proper old-fashioned chase. Like, they're going through buildings, you know. It's really, really, really fun and exciting and realized very well. I mean, the other parallel, I guess, I was thinking about it as well, between the Tintin books and this movie, is that Hergé really was more of a director. The Tintin books are like a factory produced book, in that he had teams of people. You know, somebody was specialized in doing cars, others were doing backgrounds and all that kind of stuff. And that kind of process is mirrored in the film, where Spielberg is directing it, but then someone else is realizing all these different bits and
stuff. Absolutely, yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting parallel, because mostly comics are done, you know, when you're talking about comic book translations, you know, you've got like Frank Miller or someone who did the Dark Knight, and then you've got like Christopher Nolan, and you've kind of got these maverick guys, even though they're still team in the Batman movies. You know, you've got this idea of this kind of maverick guy at the top who's got the control over everything. And I think it's really interesting to see that happen in this as well, because Hergé is one of the few kind of comic books that had that kind of churning out good quality comic books.
Yeah.
But that kind of factory idea behind it is really interesting.
Yeah. I have to say, like, on that, on the parallels between, or how much they did stay apart from, you know, lifting, you know, bits from other comic, two other Tintin books just to kind of round this off. They did, I thought, stay very faithful to the books. There's some great bits. There's the opening where Hergé himself is drawing Tintin in the market, which is great because Hergé, kind of like Hitchcock, used to appear in all his books, and he would, you know, he would appear. So I thought that was such a brilliant way.
It was a really nice way to open it up.
Really good, yeah.
And it looked, it was clever and funny, and it set in a really nice tone. And you were kind of, you were kind of relaxed, and you're like, okay, I'll give this a chance. Yeah, let's see where it goes. And, you know, I don't think it failed to deliver. It was a good film. It was, you know, like I said, I think the problems I had with the movie were the same as the problems I have with the books.
Yeah.
So in that way, it was a perfect realization of Hergé on the screen, you know, through the eyes and through the hands of Peter Jackson and Spielberg.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, in fairness, you have to do more than give them the benefit of the doubt in terms of making sure they deliver something that was worthwhile.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to get too let down by watching a Spielberg movie no matter what.
No, and especially since he's had the copyright for the Tintin film, I think, for 30 years.
Yeah, well, I think didn't Hergé say that he was the only person who could ever make it?
Yes, Spielberg actually met Hergé. Yeah, he did. And interestingly, actually, even though Hergé said, you know, Spielberg could be the only person making this into a movie, he did famously write to Walt Disney earlier on in his career asking, you know, saying, you know, like, I really like your animated films. You're the only one who could do this justice. And Disney said, listen, we're booked up for the next 4 years and we have no interest in Tintin. So
Hergé was around hurrying himself around.
He's the only guy who could possibly
I think I read somewhere as well that he went to Don Bluth's when Sylvan Bluth were here.
No way.
No, I'm joking.
That would have been a great story, but yeah, just spread lies on the comic cast.
Well, yeah.
A few nice things to look out for, I thought. There's a great bit where Tintin is he's in the sea and he's underwater, and his quiff comes out of the water like Jaws. I thought that was a lovely little nod.
Yeah.
There's actually in translating the comic book.
Reminded me of the when they're in the opening scene. There's the wall of the other characters that Hergé has drawn.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And there's an E.T. and a Wookiee.
Oh, no, I didn't see those.
I'm joking, you idiots. Of course there isn't.
Why wouldn't there be? Spielberg is the kind
Lucas
of person...
Lucas isn't involved.
Oh, yeah, Lucas. Yeah, that's true. I'm not sure whether to continue, if you're just going to lie.
Well, I'm just trying to think now. That's all I'm doing. I'm just thinking of other lies.
Things. There's actually a particularly nice touch. I thought this was really nice.
They'll probably put it in the DVD.
Yeah, they probably will.
The extended version.
There's a really nice one thing I really loved from the comic books was, you know, every time someone got a whack on the head, you'd get,
oh yeah, that was a brilliant bit.
He would say, like, have birds
but you're giving away loads of little things.
These are things to look out for. These are not major plot points, spoilers.
No, but they're the kind of little bits that you enjoy
that
seeing.
Savior,
you're flagging them out. I think that's wrong.
Okay, fine. Okay, I'll leave it.
I think there's, you know, the other, like, without going into this, without me doing it now, but I'm not gonna say exactly what happens. But at the end of that scene we were talking about, going through the Moroccan port town, there's a building. Something happens at the end with a building.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And the owner of the building does something.
Yes.
That was really,
that was
really
great.
Good.
Yes,
yeah, that was good.
Now we're just like talking in code about the film. I actually thought, again, no spoilers, but at the end, I thought the end was a bit flat. At the very end.
The ending was terrible.
I really thought the start and the end just left. At the start, I wasn't terribly excited. At the end, I wasn't really terribly excited.
The ending was really, really unusual. It was just like...
Set up for a sequel, but just not in a very exciting way at all.
No, it was... I couldn't believe it. I felt like it was really badly written. Like it wasn't the ending. Like, it was a fake ending.
I actually thought...
When it ended, it was going to start again, and we were going to have another bit.
Because
it just didn't feel like, you know, I just don't buy that whole, you know, just going to be a sequel. So you just have to, it's just going to continue.
So you just have to wait.
Because I don't think, even if it was just the end of a scene leading on to another scene, it was a good end to a scene even, never mind a good end of a movie. Mm. You know, yeah, so I agree.
Well, speaking of the writers,
are we agreeing then that the movie was terrible?
No, we're not at all.
Okay, okay.
Well, speaking of the writers, do you think, like, I mean, I was, like, when I heard Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish and Stephen
Moffat,
you know, I was really quite excited. But actually, I think because everybody was so careful to stick to the original Hergé comics, that I don't think much of their personality or flair really stuck out at all. This could have been written by anyone.
Yeah, I think it was almost written by Hergé. There was a few little touches, and there was references to other things in it that Hergé wouldn't have put in.
Yeah.
But in saying that, it wasn't like, you know, if you're a fan of Adam and Joe, you know, and their song wars and all that kind of stuff, you're not going to get any of that in it. Like, you wouldn't know that he had anything to do with, or Edgar Wright for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a pure, I mean, I don't even know, to be honest, why they were asked to do it.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I could understand why someone would ask them to do it, but then not to let them do whatever they wanted to do seems a bit strange. Not that I know what they wanted to do, but I presume they would have wanted to be a little bit more postmodern, ironic, and have more references in it. It seemed it was a little bit too reverential to the source material, but I guess they had to do it. Did they have to do that? I don't know if they had to do it. Maybe they didn't have to do it. You know, could they have flipped it around and made them... I actually read this Tintin book a couple of years ago. It was like a self-published book. You know, it wasn't authorized in any way. And Tintin was like, it was in the 80s during the miner strike.
Okay.
And he was like printing his own kind of socialist newspaper and stuff. It was quite interesting.
There's actually, just briefly on that, there's a novel, an authorized novel of Tintin that is completely the opposite of everything Tintin is. Tintin falls in love.
Well, there's another thing we haven't talked about.
Well, yeah. To talk about Tintin and why he doesn't have a love interest is really to talk about every Tintin comic.
Yeah, but if they were redoing, say, Tintin in the Congo.
Right? Yes.
They're not going to just go, well, this is in the source material, so we have to use it.
That's a bit different, because that's... You know, cruelty to animals and racism.
Yeah, well, you know, not having women in it is sexist, right?
But there is women in it. There's a few.
They're normally old women.
Yeah.
There's certainly no women or girls. I mean, what age is Tintin anyway?
Well,
he has a gun, right? He lives on his own.
People all say he's between 18 and 30. Like, so he could be easily 18, but he could be just a baby-faced 30-year-old.
Yeah, so he lives on his own with his little doll dog, right?
With his dog.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
I don't see why I don't particularly see why he has to... Like, I don't miss that. When reading the comics, I don't wish... Oh, I wish she had a love interest. It just doesn't bother me. That's in every other... In one way, he's breaking the mold by not having a love interest.
Yeah, no, I can understand that, but... At the same time, like, some of the situations I loved in, say, Indiana Jones was when he was, like, you know, bickering back and forth with his love interest or his, you know, woman that he likes, but she's been, you know, she's too smart for him. And because there's something about that period, the kind of 30s or, you know, 40s, whenever Tintin is set, that was a golden age for kind of strong women in movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was definitely something that's missing, I think, in this.
Okay.
Not just to kind of, you know, tokenist throw some women in because, you know, we're all politically correct. I think a female character to stand up to how annoying Tintin is would help him develop as a person. I'm just thinking of him.
You've got his best interests at heart.
Exactly.
And then just briefly on...
imagine how Snowy would be so jealous then.
Yeah. She might
have a cat. There could be a spin-off with Snowy and
the
cat.
That'd be amazing.
Write that down.
The cast. What did you think? I mean...
I thought Jamie Bell was, like I said, he reminded me of Frodo, his voice. It didn't have much emotion in it, I didn't think. I thought Haddock was good, and that was Andy Serkis, wasn't it? Yeah, I thought he was quite good. I thought his character in general was quite good in the film. He had some poignant moments, which is something that was missing in general from the film. You know, it was a sense of... there was a real sense that his character was actually padded out with some real emotion.
Yeah.
You know, because he started so down.
His alcoholism was really, I thought, really surprising. Yeah, to kind of, yeah. Like, obviously, reading the comics, you know he's an alcoholic, but just seeing it up on the screen in like a kind of a kids PG movie,
yeah,
adventure story, it was just like, it was very noticeable.
Well, I mean, they almost overdid it, I think. Mm. Like,
yeah,
you know, there was bits in it. You know, the bit when he's in the airplane,
yeah,
and they're about to crash. Spoiler alert. Well, I mean, this actually, you know, if you watch a trailer these days,
yeah,
you know, it's very hard to give any spoilers away because the whole movie's in the bloody trailer.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a bit where he's like looking at some alcohol, and you know, he basically puts everybody's lives at risk just for a sniff of it, like. And yeah, it was definitely interesting to see how it was depicted.
Mm.
Like I said, I thought his character was the most developed.
Yeah.
I guess you could also argue that he was a bit of a cliche as well.
Yeah.
But I suppose in the context of the movie,
yeah, yeah,
he developed from a hopeless person to a hero.
Yeah.
Over the course of the movie, whereas Tintin begins as an investigative, you know, annoying idiot, and throughout the movie remains exactly the same by the end, completely without emotional contact with anybody else,
yeah,
and you know, just focused on being a busybody, you know, with. I mean, at the beginning, you see his house, his apartment, and it's full of newspaper clippings of all the stories that he's broke. And you can see he's an egomaniac.
This is why I love him.
There's no pictures or sense that he has any family, yeah, or yeah, anyone, any connection. Well,
that's
connection.
Of course, like, that's obviously famously in the comic books, that's why all these other characters are built around him, because, yeah, they are his family, because he doesn't seem to,
yeah,
have,
but that's who he is, though. He's, yeah, he's an egomaniac who's self-obsessed, and, you know, I guess you, at the center of a lot of movies, there's the kind of main character is a bit of a kind of a blank, that the interesting characters are the ones that, yeah, revolve,
yeah,
around.
Yeah,
them.
Absolutely.
What
about like the likes of having Simon Pegg and the other chap as Thomas? So it's like, is
pointless,
that,
absolutely pointless.
Yeah, I really felt that. I really felt like when I heard this cast list, you know, it was kind of like, you know, that could be good, that could be funny, but actually, it could have been anyone.
Yeah, but I mean, really, that's the case with few exceptions in most animated films.
Mm.
Like, you know, why? I mean, obviously, from a marketing point of view,
yeah,
that's the reason.
Yeah.
You know, they have stars doing voiceovers, like. But you know, I mean, I'm sure you could probably tell me who the voice was for Snow White, like, and the Prince Charming and the Witch. But it's not important. The important thing is how amazing the film is, and you know, it doesn't, you know, you don't see the actress who played Snow White over Snow
famously
White.
Famously, like, in Disney, on the back of every Disney box, they don't mention the voice actors at all. They don't.
Well,
use
I mean,
it.
You know, that's the way it should be.
Well,
no, maybe it's not the way it should be, because obviously, if you act in it, you deserve to get credit.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
But you know,
Daniel Craig as our villain.
Well, I mean, as I already mentioned, he was a terrible villain anyway, yeah, and it was phoned in to say, you know, that's about as good as it gets from Daniel Craig.
Yeah.
When Daniel Craig, generally speaking, is only good when he doesn't open his mouth in movies. So to have him as a voice actor is not playing to his strengths. I mean, that goes without saying. He looks great as James Bond in the action scenes. He looks brilliant.
Yep.
You know, he opens his mouth and he's just not as convincing. So it was bad casting, I think.
Okay.
And it was purely based on marketing. Yeah, I think overall, you shouldn't, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think the trouble with doing proper acting for animation is that, you know, you're not just capturing them. You know, you're not just filming them doing it and using different takes. The animators have to do, have to animate them then based on what they say. And then if they suddenly change it, they have to go back and do it. You know, it doesn't lend well to ad-libbing and capturing that kind of, you know, you hear actors talking about doing scenes. They might do 50 takes and the director will pick one of them, you know, or maybe they can go back into the edit and change it. And it's very difficult to do, to get that in animation when it has to be so well storyboarded in order you know, if you change something in one scene, it could have repercussions the whole way through.
That's
the
true, but in motion capture, I mean, it cuts out other things like In terms of props and things, they don't. It can be actually kind of filmed, as it were, much quicker, because they don't have to worry about this wasn't there. The last, we need to change this prop in the room or whatever. We're just like, oh yeah, there's a fire in the corner of the room. We'll do that later, and they can just like do the scene again. You know, there's no setting up, so it can be quite a quick process.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was when it gets to things like, you know, maybe we'll touch on now the whole 3D part of
yes,
it, and 3D. Actually the 3D glasses part of it.
Okay. So I know you're not a fan of 3D.
No, I hate 3D.
And for lots
of reasons.
I'm not going to say... like
for all the reasons that everybody says they hate 3D.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Which largely I think are so redundant.
The film is dark. It's dim.
Okay. Right? I'm going to concede. Craig motion, is all saying that. I concede to that.
Right. When things move in the foreground or the background, they're blurred. And it's not just motion blur because they're moving. They're actually blurred in order to give it that effect that they're closer to you.
Yeah.
And it's just distracting. And you can actually, at some points, see two of each image around things. Okay. And it's just like, you just stop doing it. Like, do you know what I mean? And then, of course, I wear glasses. So having to watch a 3D movie with two pairs of glasses on is not the most comfortable way to watch a film.
Well, I have to say, I wear glasses as well. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. Not in the slightest.
Yeah, well, you're obviously easier to please than me. I just think it's the only reason it's there is to combat piracy. And that's not a good reason to have it. Like, there's better ways of doing it. Like, bring in a film tax, you know, and bring in a download tax. Pay 100 euros a year and you can download what you want. Loads of people would sign up for that. Fucking 3D is stupid. It's just pointless. And the Avatar was the exception that proves the rule, in that it was immersive at times, and it was deliberately shot in a way to show how good 3D could be. But no other movie is going to do that. I would say Avatar 2 was not even going to be as good.
Well, actually, I read in a couple of reviews of Tintin that people... Now, I don't agree with this, but that people thought in these reviews that Tintin was the next movie after Avatar that was able to kind of provide you with that kind of...
That immersion. Sounds like a plant... from a marketing company.
Okay.
There's no way that's true. Like, if you like,
well, it's not a case of being true. It's a case of just someone just thinking that might be the case, which I don't agree with. It wasn't.
It's just absolutely nothing in the Tintin movie that benefits from being in 3D.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just pointless.
Okay. It's probably boring to listen to the argument over 3D because it's a Marmite thing. So overall, it's a fun movie. Like, you know, like,
yeah, I think we focused on a lot of the negative stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
We did establish at the beginning that it was fun.
Yeah,
and it was exciting at times, and it was faithful to the books.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, like you said, you presumed everyone was familiar with the books and stuff. You know, lots of people don't.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they might know the name Tintin. They probably now know what he looks like from seeing trailers of the movie. Mm-hmm. I think if you like Tintin, you're going to like this movie.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
there's no doubt about that, because it is Tintin on the screen, just fleshed out a little bit, literally. And if you don't like Tintin, I think you can still enjoy the movie.
Yeah.
Because it's well made and it moves at a great pace.
But you may not necessarily become a huge
Tintin.
No,
you're not going to go back to go, I think I'll go back and rediscover those books.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be just as bad as you remember them, if you thought they were bad in the first place.
Right.
Like you were saying that Tintin is like a Marmite thing. Some people hate him, some people love him. I'm kind of, I would say... I love him, but are the books anyway, not him as a character. But even within that love, I still have things that I hate about it. You know, I don't know. I would recommend going to see it, not in 3D if possible.
Yeah.
Because I mean, they're not. Yeah, I know, I'm not getting back.
No. Let's leave the 3D. So yeah. So go see it. There is a plan, two more sequels.
I think Jackson is directing the next one,
and then they'll both co-direct the third one.
That's not going to work.
Yeah, there's going to be egos.
I would say at least one of them, i.e. Jackson, will walk out at some point.
All right, well, Bramby, thanks very much for guest reviewing.
You're welcome.
Did you enjoy it?
It was
Was it just everything you'd imagined and more?
It reminded me, it's ironic because it's kind of like the Tintin movie in that I had such low expectations and I enjoyed it. I don't know whether it was because
whether there'll be a sequel or
not. Yeah, I'm not sure there's going to be a sequel.
And we're back. I have some questions for you about the movie, since we didn't get to do a full chat about it. During the week, right, I've been following your Twitter, and maybe you've covered this in the interview, so stop me if you haven't.
Yeah.
But you've been sort of on Twitter, you know, people ask, oh, it's Tintin, and you've been sort of given, like, it's fun, you know, never saying it's good, or it's great, it's like, it's fun. And that's kind of how I would describe, say, like, you know, like a series of unfortunate events, the movie, which I quite liked, but it's not great. I like the source material. You know what I mean? I couldn't wholeheartedly recommend that movie to everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I wonder if you feel the same about Tintin or about misreading.
We didn't specifically give it any five or star rating or in that review, but I would give it 4 out of 5. You know, it is a lot of like I said fun over Twitter, because it is really kind of like when you watch Indiana Jones, like you're not watching Indiana Jones going, this is a masterpiece. Well, maybe you are if you're Stephen Mooney. But you're watching it. You're just having a laugh, like watching it. So from that perspective, it was
In terms of in terms of holding close to the source material, are you happy enough with how it went? Do you think these are good books to pick to start off a Tintin franchise?
That's something we didn't specifically talk about in the review. It's hard because he's had so many adventures.
It's not real.
Yes, stop ruining the magic. It probably was. I mean, because they've incorporated the book where Captain Haddock first meets Tintin, which was a whole separate book on its own, but they've taken those elements and added them to this other two-book story. Okay, anyway, enough of that. We've already spent 40 minutes listening to me and Bren
talk about it.
First thing I did when I came out of the cinemas, I went,
jerk yourself off while crying and lost dreams.
I went straight to Chapters and I picked up The Art of the Adventures of Tintin, the movie. There is the art of books from the comics. So this is a very nice kind of coffee table book by Chris Skies. And it has a foreword by Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson. And yeah, basically this is just one of those kind of all the production art behind the movie. And it is actually quite interesting because found out stuff like, which I didn't know, was that Spielberg had intended this to be live action. And that when he approached Weta, is it Weta?
Yeah, I think so.
When he approached them, it was with it in mind of them making Snowy, who was going to be just, you know, completely digital. And they actually, and there's photographs of an actual live action test, which looked kind of crazy. And they were just a test, like, you know, with a technician or whatever. But,
sure.
And there's another test they did with Peter Jackson as Captain Haddock and the CG Snowy.
He does look a bit like Captain
Haddock. Yeah, he does. There's like a picture of him like in the gear somewhere. So there's some really nice stuff in this. Particularly, they did an exercise in the company where when they found out Spielberg wanted to do this, he wanted to know what Tintin, the comic, would look like if it was kind of done, you know, in real life or, you know, this kind of CG way. So as an exercise, they got every artist they had to pick their favorite panel from any of the comic books so they're all in here. So you have like, you have quite a lot of the covers, which are great, actually. In particular, the covers of Tintin comics are really well composed. And so there's a lot of the cover. There's a lot of like Destination Moon, really great covers. So they're all in there. Then of course, like it's quite detailed. They go through everything from the characters and how they progress and how difficult it was to really like it, especially when you see Tintin and they show you all the different ways. And then they found like, you know, that a way they'd drawn Tintin that when they made it into a CG counterpart, when he smiled, say, then it would all go wrong. It wouldn't look right. It'd look creepy. Sure. And they're actually, that's what I like about there's little kind of blurbs from designers and artists in it. And they're really quite like, just, they're a little bit more frank and honest than I imagined would be in an official book, just in terms of what they're doing. So really, it is only for like, It is only if you're a diehard Tintin fan and you have an interest in the kind of making of the movie, but it is completely exhaustive. Every scene that you see in the movie, like every room they go into, show you pictures of it and little descriptions of how they went about it. Yeah, and it just kind of details some of the kind of behind the scenes of motion capture, which is an interesting process.
Sure.
In itself, this is €25.
Oh.
It's your Christmas present, buddy. It's 25 quid in chapters. Or I picked it up in chapters anyway. If you like Tintin and you like the movie, you will definitely like this.
Cool.
Where are we now in the show?
Reviewed Tintin's The Art of
Devotion. Since this is a Tintin show, I just wanted to mention one or two things that you may be interested in if you are a fan of Tintin. Shut up, you. Just done this on my own. Last year, the British Film Institute brought out two Tintin movies from the 60s. Live action, the only live action movies ever made. And I reviewed one of them at the time. But the other one is Tintin and the Blue Oranges, which is not based on, both of these films were not based on a specific comic.
Oh, okay.
They were kind of overseen by Hergé, but they were just completely existed, which I think kind of probably suited these. But they're really great, they're really fun. I think if you like Tintin, you're just going to enjoy it. It's the same way, you know what I mean? If I don't know, what do you like? You'll blanket like...
Oh, absolutely.
Batman stuff. So they're both available from the British Film Institute. Another kind of thing that I think we mentioned before, what's very interesting in the Tintin world is... that's what it's called. It's called Tintin in the New World. and it's by Frederick Tootin. And this is a novel about Tintin. And what's really bizarre about this is Tintin... like he's grown up in this. He's like, you know, he's not old, but he's suddenly a fully realized character. He has a love interest in this. It's all very like it's just very adult.
And has this been approved of by?
The
Tintin Estate.
Let's see. Yeah. So the author was actually a friend of Hergé. Yeah. So I'm not sure if this was approved by. The people who look after Tintin, it came out after Hergé's death, but I imagine like it's published by a proper publisher. It's got Tintin on the front. I imagine it was approved in some way. It's an interesting it's a curiosity in the Tintin universe.
Sure.
And also just to mention that as I've been going around, obviously with the movie, all bookshops are like starting to restock their Tintin comics, and in every shop. They seem to be buy one, get one free,
cool.
Which is a pretty sweet deal.
Yeah.
Of them. Can I really recommend you don't buy, they've brought out these kind of hardback collections, which are about a quarter of the size of the original ones that fit maybe like three volumes into one. But like the squash everything down. And like on some pages, it's quite a lot of text and they're really hard to see. They're really horrible anyway. You should just get these lovely...
I really like that. Did you buy this one just recently? One we have here, The Secret of Unicorn. I like that they haven't put a fucking shitty movie cover on the front and ruined the original cover.
That's pretty
impressive.
Yeah. I would absolutely hate that. That concludes our Tintin special.
Sure. And thus begins our Halloween special.
Halloween is over, man.
Just over. But I mean, we didn't have a Halloween special a month ago, and we didn't have it Halloween.
Okay, tell me a ghost story.
I do. I have one good Halloween story, and then we'll call it a day. Well, it isn't really a Halloween story, but you'll see. And I'm actually curious if any listeners have had the same thing happen to them, because this is like one of the most fucked up things that's ever happened to me, right? When I was in primary school, when I was in fourth class, I was about 10 or 11, I guess. We had our teacher come in and talk to us about various things, like drugs and stuff, you shouldn't do drugs. And they had a thing about drugs, and I went on for half an hour. Like, this whole talk took about the whole afternoon. So talking about drugs, and then I can't remember exactly alcohol anyway, but I remember the last one in the series of things, you know, you to watch out for it to never do. The last one was Ouija boards. in the same conversation as drugs. do not use Ouija boards. And there's like, it was totally serious. Like, look, we don't want you contacting the dead, you know? we don't want you opening that kind of worms.
I'm sorry, maybe I've missed something, but I mean, like, I don't want to go near a Ouija board. I'm not...
You understand, like, that is not real, right?
I have no proof.
Sure, but there's no proof.
As far as I'm concerned, I've seen in X-Files episodes where kids mess around with
but
Ouija
boards. But there's no proof that it's not real, but there's no proof it is real. Unlike drugs. Where there's hardcore proof of the damage they do. Where Ouija boards...
We should have got a Ouija board for this episode. We should have.
Because I remember, like, because it fucked me up for years. Because I remember I was in Forbidden Planet, I'd say I was about 16, and they had a Ouija board, a Hellboy Ouija board. I was like...
Hellboy Ouija.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, you're allowed to sell those. Aren't those illegal? Someone's going to be contacting the dead. The dead could be coming back right now. And Pandora's box has been opened. I was wondering, I was curious if anyone else was warned of the dangers of Ouija boards in the same sentence as one was warned.
Comment below.
Yeah. Let us know. So I hope you have your tummy full of sweets from all your Halloween trick-or-treating. And we'll talk to you in a few weeks.
To the next adventure. Thank you.